question and all the contradictions and overwhelming problems that seem to be ahead of me. As you know, I am now 25 years of age and ready to begin my life's work. How frightening that is. And yet how thrilling. As I wrote to Lucy, dear Lucy Stone, who shared my earlier years here at Overland with me, I wrote, "What shall I do, Lucy, when my studies are finished? I don't like the idea of teaching at all, and I'm in some debt for my education. The probability is that I shall go to Cincinnati and do whatever I can find to do there. Oh, there's not a friend in the whole wide world, as far as I know, that can feel that I'm acting wisely in that call of God. Yeah. Everything is so pleasant, and my heart is so full and almost running over with happiness. I met arrived at Overland." Sounds like the hand of God. Oh, what a difficult and money.
Then I took the stagecoach, which carried me the last 15 miles to Overland. During this ride
on the stagecoach, a friend told me that I should not have much to do with Lucy Stone, as she was quite eccentric and talked far too much about women's rights. Of course,
that made me determined to get to know her and
find out all about her. At dinner after I arrived at Overland, Lucy Stone was at the next table. Soon we were dearest friends, sharing sweet secrets and spending long nights planning our lives and our careers. We were, one evening, facing a beautiful sunset, and we both
stopped and looked. I told my
intention to her of becoming a minister. Her
protest was
most emphatic. She said, "You will never be allowed to do this. You will never be allowed to stand in a pulpit or preach in a church. And certainly, you can never be ordained." My answer was, "I am going to do it." Now, 3 years ago, when Lucy and I finished our first degrees, she went off to New England speaking on abolition, while I stayed on to study theology. I have now finished my studies, but I did not graduate. I was not allowed to graduate, for that would have been seen as an endorsement of my probable future as a minister by the faculty of Overland. It has been such agony sometimes to talk with the professors who believe that women should only learn enough theology to be able to support their husbands. Certainly they had no need to learn to preach. Once I was given an assignment to write an essay on the biblical passage, 1 Corinthians 14, 34, "The women should keep silent in the churches." The purpose, of course, was to discourage me. I had hoped to teach younger girls in the preparatory department and thereby earn money for my modest needs. But the ladies' board passed a resolution forbidding female Overland graduates from teaching in the preparatory school. Bitterness is not my way, but my earnest judgment tells me that this resolution was aimed directly at me. And so it seems so unreasonable that I should be hindered in my ambition and my call. From the time I began praying in our family devotions, I was only five,
And I have known that my spirit was seeking for God's love and striving to understand His will.
I'd already been reading biblical passages for 2 years,
and my faith has flowered continuously ever since. Now,
I feel sure that I can earn my living by writing,
lecturing, or as last
resort by teaching, but it is the ministry that beckons my heart. Theology encompasses the whole world, leaving the range of human thought open
for investigation, and all human
relations ready for the application of perceived principles. There is no study so uplifting, so rigorous, so meaningful as this. The understanding of Christian principles
and the knowledge. The last
5 years pilgrimage
through scholarly pursuits. I know
what lies ahead,
but I am secure in my trust
in God, and in spite of my happiness, I do sometimes feel a vague sensation of dread and apprehension when I think of the grim, unknown future ahead.
It's been since I talked to you. Oh, so much has happened. Nearly 20 years.
What did I do?
Well, my friend Mrs. Barnes offered me a position. She promised to find me lodgings and to pay me a salary if I would go to New York and work with the poor women in the slums there. She stipulated that I could speak and preach and lecture as much as I pleased, as I took care of my duties. I agreed. But as I was preparing to move to New York, I attended an anti-slavery convention in Oswego. I went eagerly, hoping to be able to speak forthrightly from the
platform on my views about that subject. Sadly, I found that women were not allowed to speak on
an active role in invitation to the first National Women's Convention, which was held in 1850 in Worcester,
Massachusetts. There,
I met other feminist leaders like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott.
And in this instance, I was urged to speak my presentation, and I gave a revision of my Overman paper on the biblical prohibition of women speaking in public. That I was viewed as a radical, and the women who I intended to work with in New York became decidedly cool.
And that earned my spirit to pursue the lecture circuit. My success in this endeavor was very gratifying, and I was often asked to preach by liberal ministers such as Samuel J. May and William Henry Channing. But
of having a small church
of my own. And in 1853, I was called to Butler, New York, where my salary was $300 a year. That summer, I was finally able to overcome all difficulties and was ordained by my little parish. The Great Wall of Custom had been breached. Now, another
important circumstance
was a visit from a distinguished gentleman, a Mr. Samuel Blackwell. He came one day to call upon me, and we spent nearly half the day conversing on all manner of topics. Only later did I learn of Lucy's attempts at matchmaking. She had met Mr. Henry Mr. Samuel Blackwell's younger brother, and was quite taken by him. And she urged Mr. Samuel Blackwell to visit me on his next journey to New York State. And he did so. That was the beginning of a very important friendship. The National Women's Rights Convention in Cleveland invited me to speak on the biblical prohibition position of women, and my discourse provoked much controversy. My firm conviction is that the Bible supports the rights and well-being of all people. Thus, the Bible supports the abolition of slavery, the use of temperance in drinking alcoholic beverages. I believe it also supports the rights of women to equity. But others in the movement view religion and the Bible as oppressive of women and claim that Christianity must be renounced if women are to progress. I began to feel alone in my convictions and unsupported by my feminist friends. And let me tell you of my other growing doubts. For a time, I had been associated with liberal ministers of many events. Liberal Quakers, Unitarians, and others who question orthodoxy as well as traditional social patterns. Inevitably, I had absorbed some of their thinking. The conflict came to a head for me when the illegitimate child of a member of my congregation died. It became my task to raise the child and teach him that God would cause the suffering and death of an innocent child to punish its mother? Could I have faith in such a God? I found myself less and less able to preach with conviction in the way I was expected to preach to my people. My theology was shaken, and I finally resolved my pastorate. Now, through this difficult time when my religious conviction was disturbing me, my firm support from my feminist friends was dissolving, my relationship with Mr. Samuel Blackwell was deepening and growing. In May of 1855, Lucy Stone and Henry Blackwell were married, and perhaps that gave my Mr. Blackwell the courage to propose marriage to me. I said, I could learn to love you dearly by sharing thoughts and interests and confidences as I have loved few friends before, but that is all. I could never think of you as more than a friend. And his response was, I don't ask you for anything but friendship. So later we spent more time together, and finally, in the greatest of secrecy, we began to plan our wedding. Now, I don't know how the rumor started, but someone seemed to know that Samuel Blackwell was planning to be married, though no one knew who the bride was to be. I still laugh when Susan Anthony questioned me, will you not feel badly when Sam is married? For at that very moment, he was with my father asking for my hand. We were married in January of 1956. I did not agree with Lucy that a woman should keep her own name after her marriage. I did, however, feel that I should use my title. So I have always been known as the Reverend Antoinette L.B. Blackwell. My new husband and I settled in New Jersey, and I wrote to Susan that I would be a good wife and go wherever my husband goes, though I shall talk a great deal. There was never any question of my continuing my lectures on abolition and temperance and women's issues. an activity I'd been committed to, though interrupted by the birth of children. Florence, our first daughter, was born 11 months after our marriage, and Mabel, 15 months later. The National Women's Rights Convention, scheduled for the fall of 1857, had to be canceled because nearly all of us were having babies. Susan was so dismayed. In the fall of 1859, I began a dream of mine, preaching in New York. Each week, I took the boat to New York on Sunday afternoon, preached in a hired hall, and returned to Newark in the evening. I managed to keep up this demanding schedule for quite a while, but finally I had to discontinue it because the money taken in the offering was not enough to cover the expenses. My major theme, though, was my theological understanding of God as the all-in-all of mind and spirit, and as the creator of the universe by the limitation of his own powers in the limited individual unit of his creation. Now, during the Civil War, I remember, we discontinued most activities except those connected with the support of the Union. Lucy and Susan organized the Women's National Loyal League, which I supported. When the war was over, and we began to realize that Negro men would be given the right to vote, but women, whether black or white, would not, we knew we had to renew our struggle. The question of strategy split us in a most dreadful way. Susan and Elizabeth Cady Stanton formed the National Women's Suffrage Association.
They were opposed to the 14th and 15th Amendments
to the Constitution, unless women were added to them. Lucy and Julia Ward Howe formed the American Women's Suffrage Association, which addressed all the issues affecting women, not just suffrage. This division tore my allegiance, and I found I could support neither. Therefore, I understood that women's movement as only one of many ways in which God was working for the moral progress of the universe, and political activity seemed to be only a small part of the work to be done. And by this time, my husband and I had been blessed by five lovely daughters, and the demands of domestic life were very heavy. I therefore felt I could withdraw from public life and use my energies caring for my family while writing for publication. Summer hike for the entire Brown Blackwell family, hasn't it? All of our children are here, along with Henry Blackwell. Lucy died in 1893, you know. And their daughter, Nan, with her family is here. Oh my, yes, yes, quite a group. And the freshness of the air. God has blessed us. I passed my 75th birthday in May, and I believe I talked to you just over 25 years ago, or was it 30? Time loses some of its meaning as one ages. My first book was published in 1869, and my last daughter was born that same year. My, what a fruitful and productive period that was. But it was only the beginning of my serious writing.
The exciting books of Charles Darwin and Herbert Spencer have set my heart and head
into the struggle for integration of these
new ideas into the structure of Christianity.
My book, Studies
in General Science, reaffirmed the superior place of the human soul in the universe. 2 years later, my novel, The Island of
Neighbors, was published, and I was
particularly pleased with the reception of this book, for it told in disguised form of our lives here on the vineyard.
But soon, of course, I was back writing on women's issues. My articles appeared in many magazines, and I was in great demand as a presenter of papers at conferences. My most meaningful work addressed the necessity for women to participate in public life and the related obligation of men to help them by sharing household tasks.
At the first Congress of the Association for the
Advancement of Women, I said, let no woman give all of their time to household duties, but require all women and all men also, since they do belong to the household, to bear some share
of the common household burdens. Ours was a shared household, and Mr. Blackwell supported the division of labor. Fortunately,
his sweet temperament and gentle nature made him an almost perfect father. We were able to afford some domestic help, like a maid and a governess, who relieved us of many routine tasks. Still,
I was often
interrupted.
I did a little of 100 things every day and not much of
anything.
Oh, yes. Of course,
I wrote an answer to Dr. Edward Hammond Clark
after his book, Sex and
Education,
or A Fair Chance for Girls,
was published. He wrote all that nonsense about education
interfering
with a girl's delicate female organization. He said a girl
who pursued intellectual goals risked the dire results of draining
energy from her reproductive functions, her divinely appointed task.
My book, The
Sexes Throughout Nature, I challenged the accepted theory that the male is the representative type of the species and the female a modification preordained in the interests of reproduction. My most powerful book,
The Physical Basis of Immortality, represented a synthesis of all my philosophical and scientific studies. I used principles of physics, such as the indestructible nature of matter, to expand the doctrine of the immortality of the soul. The reviews were very favorable. In 1879, I was most gratified to be awarded an honorary Master of Arts degree from Auburn. It was a bit amusing, for I had earned that degree after studying 30 years before. Yet they called it honorary. With this
confirmation of my professional standing, I again sought a parish, but without success. The success that did brighten my spirit was the resolution of the differences between the National Women's Suffrage Association and the American Women's Suffrage Association. Others helped, of course, but my efforts to bring Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan Anthony together with Lucy Stone and Alice
Blackwell were crucial to the
association was formed.
Leadership is slowly being passed to younger women by Carrie Chapman Hatch
and the Reverend Howard Shaw, who will carry on the struggle. It is such a pleasure to see you again.
Well, my eyes are so inadequate that it's difficult to distinguish faces. Fortunately, my large family takes turns reading to me and writing at my dictation. So I am able to carry on my work, though it does seem that my work is nearing its end. The hardest part of living so long, I am 96 now, is watching so many friends and loved ones leave this life, but I remain behind. Dear Mr. Blackwell passed away 20 years ago. Elizabeth, his sister, you know, the one who was our first woman doctor passed away nearly 10 years ago. Henry Blackwell, too, is gone. But I must not dwell on the losses when there are so many triumphs to be celebrated. My two books, The Thinking of the Universe and The Social Side of Mind and Action, appeared in 1914 and 15.
These precious volumes represent the culmination of my 60 years of study and analysis.
My theory, which I proved to my satisfaction, is that the universe is a working
thought scheme of the Creator, and that all manifestations of the Creator at work
are interdependent and correlated. Even worlds of human machines and social organizations
are revelations of God.
Yes. Another wonderful and fulfilling
event occurred in my life. I am finally recognized as a minister connected with a congregation. My designation is
Minister Emeritus of the Unitarian Society of Elizabeth, New Jersey. In 1903, I helped organize this church, and I conducted services there. A portion of the plot where my house stood was donated to the parish, and they built a small building. Eventually, a new minister was called, and I was designated Minister Emeritus, continuing to preach once a month until very recently, when I found I no longer had the strength for this task.
In 1908, Oberlin College again honored me, this time with a Doctor of Divinity degree.
In addition, my name was placed in the roll of official graduates of the theology school for the year 1850.
Well, I spent no time on anger or recriminations about how
little Oberlin had done to help me advance. I simply made sure that I had the proper doctor's gown for the ceremony. Last year was particularly memorable. The suffrage question had gained momentum with various states enacting women's suffrage laws. The parades
that had taken place during the previous years
had dramatized this issue nationally. I rode in nearly all of them as one of my daughters or nieces. I was the matriarch of the suffrage movement. Finally, in 1918, the House of Representatives passed the Anthony Amendment, which was ratified by the states in time for the 1920 elections. On November the 2nd, we drove in to Elizabeth, where we expected to join
a waiting line of voters.
But when I arrived, they all drew aside and allowed me to go directly into the booth. I told the clerk I wished to vote the Republican ticket, all things considered, at the present time. It seems to me to be the wisest plan. Yes, I voted for President Harvey, who had supported women's suffrage and prohibition during his many years in the Senate. And so, I am peaceful and content. I doze and dream and daydream much and can feel more and more that I live only in my own internal world. Life has been rich and good. I am not afraid of death, which will lead me